Great. Well, after that very full and robust and interesting discussion, it's a huge pleasure now to welcome our final plenary speaker for the morning, Professor Veronica Miller, who's the Director of the Forum for Collaborative HIV Research and the Visiting Professor of University of California, Berkeley, who's coming to tell us, which I think is actually in the light of the last discussion, incredibly important, who's going to discuss with us PrEP trial design. So, Professor Miller.
So thank you very much. I guess the mic works, right? Mm-hmm. Good. So that was a very stimulating panel discussion, and I'm not quite sure that you really want to hear about the research part, the clinical research part, now that we've spent so much time talking about the implementation. But let me run through some of the thoughts I had. And I have to confess that I actually extensively reworked my talk this morning because I thought I would really kind of make it more discussion-oriented rather than a lot of summary slides of data that we already know and data that has already been published. So first of all, I just want to say when I use the term PrEP in this context of this talk, I basically mean pre-exposure prophylaxis using ARVs. So it can be oral, it can be topical, it can be injectable, it can be rings. It's really kind of talking about that whole thing. And I think at some point we have to really move over into that kind of terminology. So basically, in July 2012, as we all know, FDC and tenofovir were approved as the formulation of Truvada, as an oral formulation was approved for PrEP. And the new label indication is the bottom part of that little insert there. Truvada is indicated in combination with safer sex practices for pre-exposure prophylaxis to reduce the risk of sexually acquired HIV in adults at high risk. So notice no specific population. It's just simply in adults at high risk. So before that, where were we? So the big question was, will it work? And that affected our clinical trials because we couldn't tell participants in the trials, you know, we know this works and we're testing what works against something that might or might not work or might work better. But the question always was, will it even work regardless if you're taking placebo or not? And a lot of the trials that were done really, in my opinion, sort of moved along the efficacy effectiveness continuum. A lot of questions about what populations should we be doing this, what is the dosing regimen, is it quarterly dependent or is it once daily? A lot of people were thinking that we were duplicating efforts because we were doing several trials in Africa and women and young women, et cetera. And it really was sort of this public health approach to prevention research. But the one constant amongst all those trials was that they were all placebo-controlled. But then basically in July 2012, we have the FDA approval. So the answer to the question, will it work, is yes, at least sometimes. And that really then leaves us with now what? So as we're moving forward on the other side, on the right-hand side of that divide, this is the time when the landscape really changed. We have an active control arm if the trial decides to use that. But we are trying out a number of different types of regimen and also different modalities. We have to think about demonstrating efficacy within the context of a very heterogeneous effect because PrEP had worked in some cases and not in others. There are diverse perspectives from the FDA and other agencies around the world. There are ethical challenges in terms of how do we design these trials in the context, is Truvada available for treatment or not? Is Truvada available for PrEP or not? So all of these questions really make it quite complicated, and the question is a placebo control even, you know, indicated, or is that even ethically feasible, has been asked. So in PrEP research challenges, and this really is the clinical trial part, not the implementation or the demonstration projects, you know, we know all about these. So we have a large number of participants are required. We need to have the sites selected and maintained. We need to worry about the incidence rate. We need to really work on the community engagement, buy-in, and support. And then the kinds of things we're addressing are we addressing efficacy or effectiveness, adherence? The importance of adherence has been stated over and over and over at this conference. The kinds of designs we're using in terms of statistical approaches, what are our control arms? what is the intersect between behavior and biology, what populations are we looking at, and of course long-term safety. So really that whole left-hand part really is about the kinds of resources we have and the landscape we have to work with. And the right-hand side really is about the trial design and the trial conduct. And of course these two really interrelate with each other because the trial design type will also determine or really impact the trial size, et cetera, and the kinds of resources you have to put in it. But what I will really focus on today is really this part of the slide in terms of the trial design and trial conduct that we need to think of. And I'll just be going through these individual topics. So first of all, efficacy and effectiveness continuum. So for efficacy and effectiveness, for efficacy, we really think about the true biologic efficacy. So if we had 100% adherence, what could this product actually do? And that way we determine, is this a product that has potential to be effective or not? And it's sort of the question, can we build it? You know, as in when, if we build it, will they come? So can we actually build it? And it really has to do with drug development. So is this something that can actually be developed? And I'll talk about that a little bit later. Effectiveness is really in the real world, and we don't know what the percent adherence is going to be. And then the question is really, if we build it, will they come? That's really the part of the question there in terms of effectiveness research. And it's really about how these products then get implemented and delivered into the real world settings. So if we want to increase our chances of success on the regulatory side, we can really increase the number of candidates that we put into this pathway. And the pathway involves, you know, knowing what the regulatory pathway is, really understanding the benefit risk of each of the products, how is it going to be manufactured, what is the pricing. So that's sort of all part of that development side. On the delivery side, we can increase our chances of success if we enhance our understanding of what the market really wants and what the market will bear. And so we have things like the acceptability of the product, the epidemiologic impact, cost-effectiveness, and affordability. And I just want to highlight here Steve Becker's talk that I was at in March of this year that I've adapted some of this information from. And, of course, as in everything, there's always this back and forth between the development part and the delivery side. And you can't really split them apart completely, but just in terms of being a little bit simplistic and looking at this, let's just try and do that. So to me, it's just very clear that we just don't have any chance at effectiveness if there's no efficacy. So the efficacy part sort of comes first. And once we know that, then we can look at effectiveness. So to demonstrate efficacy, we need randomized clinical trials. And this would be the experimental new agent versus an active control or placebo. Some people think a placebo would be okay in some settings. We really want to do this under optimal conditions. I think what we really need to do to drive this forward is continue our quest for surrogate markers so that we can get away from this incidence of HIV infection, which is now the only endpoint that we have. To demonstrate effectiveness, we can also use randomized trials, but then we would have prioritized products that we would put into these very large trials. And we can obviously do an experimental new intervention versus an active control, but we can also compare strategy A versus strategy B. We can also use demonstration projects and use implementation research methodology to get at some of these questions. So I see this effectiveness as really being sort of starting off with a randomized clinical trial, but then sort of bridging off into these other kinds of research methodologies. And just when we look back at the HIV treatment situation, you know, we're very familiar with that in the treatment situation. So we have the efficacy trials, the INDs trials that get submitted to the regulatory agency. The drug then has a label and has an indication. But then a number of strategy trials will follow, and they can be done by the drug sponsor, or they can be done by a trial network, or they can be done by clinical investigators. And these will compare different ART regimen and different types of patients. And some of them may actually then lead to the potential to expand the label or the indication. But if we kind of think of that in PrEP research, maybe that will help simplify the approach a little bit. So in terms of adherence, then that's the next topic. So if we're then looking at efficacy trials, what can we do about adherence? We know adherence is very important. I promised you I was not going to show you a summary slide of the trials that have adherence and efficacy in them, because you've seen that, you know that data very well. But so in terms of, you know, the optimal conditions for doing an efficacy trial, we need to provide adequate adherence support. We need to consider enriching for adherent participants so that we actually have a chance of showing what we want to show. And we need to establish and use the best practices for documenting adherence, whether it's drug levels and, you know, when do we measure them, how often, and where are they taken from the sampling. Are we doing it in real time? There's new technologies that can be used to really look at adherence. And, of course, we need to assess adherence in the placebo or the active control group. So we can sidestep some of the adherence issues if we use long-acting injectable products or vaginal rings, but we still need to measure the adherence in a control group, so we can't really sidestep the adherence completely. Now, for the effectiveness studies, of course, adherence will still be important, but there again, we can take the best practices that we have gleaned from the efficacy trials for both increasing adherence and measuring adherence in these different populations. So it may be different for discordant couples versus IDUs or MSM. And here again, I think very early on we need to do the appropriate marketing research that will tell us why in some populations the drug will be taken or the product will be taken and others not. Now, regarding the basic clinical trial design, we can do a superiority trial or a non-inferiority trial. The superiority trial, we have a head-to-head comparison. We say that the experimental intervention is better or it's not better than the active control. And this, for example, could be done in settings where FDC TDF had little or no effect. And this is based on a wonderful article by Deb Donnell and her colleagues, which was published in JATES in 2013. And she had also given a talk based on this at a meeting that the forum sponsored in January 2013. And you can see those slides on our website. In the NI study, the non-inferiority study, basically what we're doing is we're ruling out the unacceptable increase in risk of HIV infection for the experimental arm versus the active control. And this is dependent on the previously randomized study of what is now the active control to the placebo. So this is where it gets very tricky, and this article does a very good job of explaining it, so I really don't want to get into the details of the non-inferiority margin and what it all entails. But it's tricky in our PrEP situation because the effect of the active control in the previous trial needs to be large, and we need to be able to precisely estimate it so that if we then set a margin for the new experimental treatment, that we can be sure that this is really something that is a valid assessment. And so both of these have their issues. In terms of control arms, we could think about using FDC-TDF as a control arm so that people get randomized to either get that or get the new intervention. And in this case, the experimental could be other oral agents or other modalities like an injectable or vaginal ring, et cetera, or topical. If the FDC and TDF is provided just as a background prevention package so that people could choose to either take it or not take it just the way they would choose to use the condom they were provided or not use it, then with the experimental, you really are kind of limited to only using that in settings where you have the topical gel or the vaginal ring, because you wouldn't really want to then have drug-drug interactions with the new intervention that you're studying unless that was very carefully evaluated before. So it sort of almost then goes into, are you doing a full ART treatment regimen versus just PrEP? Like I say, some people are very adamant about no placebo ever anymore, but there are other people that say, well, there's in certain settings where placebo arm would be available. For example, in settings, populations that do not accept FTC TDF, or in populations where this regimen of Truvada just didn't prove effective at all. So I will leave that for the ethicists to discuss further.
So the biology behavior continuum. So you have a product that works. So what can the behavioral pitfalls be? So we've already discussed the adherence. So I just said see above. We've kind of gone through that. But then the other part of the behavior is the transmission risk behavior, risk compensation. So how do we deal with risk compensation in trials? I think for efficacy trials, again, we really want to have the optimal situation there to say, does this product have a chance of working or not? So we need to minimize risk compensation by implementing the best practices that we have learned from the studies already done, like IPREX and others, for combination prevention practice in the optimal setting. And also we need to know how to, we need to really learn and continue learning how to assess risk compensation, whichever methodology you want to use. And we also need to start to learn to understand the contribution of this risk compensation behavior to the efficacy results. And then when you go to the effectiveness study, it just kind of brings it up on a larger scale. So hopefully we'll understand a little bit more already about the contribution of risk compensation to PrEP efficacy based on the trials that have already happened, based on the efficacy studies we've done with this intervention. And then we can start establishing the best practices for decreasing compensation in the real world. So in population, so my major question here is, at what point will we feel comfortable to say that PrEP for MSM equals PrEP for IDU equals PrEP for heterosexuals? So at what point do we say we don't have to repeat every new intervention in all three groups? And obviously, how much can we translate from the optimal conditions of the efficacy studies to the real-world population? And again, I think here demonstration studies and implementation research will be very helpful. And if I can just kind of go back to the treatment context once again. So it used to be in treatment, of course, we had to have clinical endpoints such as new AIDS-defining events or death, and then we had the surrogate marker viral load, and that became sort of the gold standard. But in treatment, for the longest time, we still had to do, I mean, we still basically have to do trials that show the viral load efficacy with the 24-week regimen for the accelerated approval and then going all the way out for 48 for the traditional approval. But basically what the FDA has been saying recently is, well, that part of it has been so well established that if we know that the viral load gets decreased in the first 8 weeks or the first 4 weeks, we can sort of rest assured that that's going to happen and that's going to be long term. So they have, in terms of doing trials in heavily pretreated patients, they have proposed clinical trial designs that say, well, if you can show that you have this virologic effect when you add a new drug to an already existing regimen, and you can show that effect over 8 weeks, then really what you need to do after that is have safety. You don't have to keep proving the antiviral effect over and over again. And also, I don't want to digress too much, but in HCV drug development, we've really seen that adoption, that once you've shown the virologic efficacy, you don't have to keep proving it in these large phase 3 trials over and over. And that's why we have two new HCV drugs, you know, coming up for a review in October. So what I'm saying here in PrEP is at some point we need to feel comfortable that if something works in one population and we have shown that Truvada works in all three populations, you know, do we really need to then study Maraviroc or the injectable or whatever in all these populations? In terms of long-term safety, again, we have these three different areas of safety. One is the drug toxicity and special situations such as pregnancy. We have the issue of drug resistance, which we need to monitor. And then the behavioral risk, the safety risk here is the risk compensation, which we don't really have for treatment, but in here we do. So really what I wanted to remind folks that in terms of regulatory pathway, a drug really is the active ingredient, the active, you know, pharmaceutical ingredient, and the intended use. So a drug isn't just an active ingredient. So the drug really is that in the intended use. So Truvada now, you know, used to be an active ingredient that was indicated for treatment. It is now an active ingredient that's also indicated for prevention. And so the efficacy is why we have the drug, but the safety is really the drug is conditional on the safety being adequate. And really what we have is sort of the efficacy-safety balance, which translates into benefit-risk balance. And the FDA is now really, even more so than before, really committed to formalizing how they do these benefit-risk analysis, these assessments. And so this has to do with the last PDUFA, the PDUFA 5, and where they have said that they really want to implement a structured risk-benefit assessment framework for everything they review. So it will be interesting to see how future PrEP products get reviewed under this new in this new context. So for PrEP safety assessment, we have the pre-marketing world. So if the drug has already been used in treatment, like Truvada has or Maraviroc has, then, of course, we'll have some history of what the drug does in people, mostly in HIV-infected people, not in negative, but we'll have some kind of idea of what the toxicity might be. And then, of course, we'll have information coming from the efficacy and effectiveness study. Then, as Jim mentioned, there's post-marketing commitments, and especially the REMS program, which is the Risk Evaluation Mitigation Strategy, which will provide a lot of good information in terms of the ongoing safety issues. And I just wanted to finish up with another approach, which we haven't talked about and I don't think has really been addressed that much in the PrEP world, which is adaptive trial design. And this is just a summary page from Lang, published in the American Journal of Tropical Medicine Hygiene in 2011. So really the adaptive trial design makes use of a single process where you start with maybe a number of different arms, and as the trial proceeds, you make decisions about, you know, you'll have some checkpoints regarding, you know, you need to have certain blood levels or certain tissue levels or other things that help you decide along the way that you want to continue that approach or that specific dosing regimen or, you know, whichever these different things are that you're comparing. And Lang makes the point that these adaptive trial designs have been used a lot in oncology and other fields, but really have not been applied to public health. And what she mentions is that we really have an understanding gap, so that if we really want to start thinking about this, we're going to have to do some educating because a lot of people are not really familiar with this, and certainly you need to have the right statistical expertise to do that. But in this recent article by Larry Corey and Tony Fauci in Science Translational Medicine, they talk about, you know, adaptive clinical trial designs. You know, we need to start for vaccine research, start applying them. And I'm saying, well, maybe we should really think also applying them to PrEP research. So in this figure here, we basically have the five major vaccine trials that we've had showing the length of time from trial start to end, how much time it took to the trial analysis and results, and how much time it took to find immune correlates if they were available. And then in a adaptive trial design, you would start off with a bunch of things in phase one, and then in phase two, start looking for some kind of a positive signal and take those agents forward. So it really compresses that whole timeline quite substantially and improves the cost-effectiveness of research. So that's it. So in summary, I think it's complicated. I hope I didn't oversimplify it, but I don't think it's insurmountable. And I think what we need to do is just continuing getting all these different experts together and all of these different stakeholders together, and we need to have a commitment that we want to move this forward. So all of this talk about implementation of Truvada is great, and I think we should also think about, you know, once we have another product on the market, you know, what will the implementation look like then when it's not just one thing that's available? Maybe if there's a long-acting or a vaginal ring as well, that will be very helpful. So I promised you no summary slides, so I've not told you about what's on the horizon, but you've heard that many times, and I thank you for your attention.
Bonnie, thank you very much indeed. We've got time to take a couple of questions. Are there any burning points? Yes. Helen, far away.
Thank you. It's Helen Rees from South Africa. Thank you very much for that. There's a lot of food for thought. I think one area that I'd like us to also think about in terms of child design is that, and this isn't really talking now about the oral prep that is proven and into the future, but it's really going back to this massive challenge you've got about coitally dependent products and how we're going to design those trials. Because if we keep seeing this pattern of, you know, which we really haven't understood properly, but we keep seeing this pattern of women joining trials and not using product, how are we going to design trials that will allow us that kind of product to be proven? So it's not something that you address, but I do think it's something that we're going to have to grapple with. Obviously we're waiting for the facts results, but if we see a similar pattern going on with facts, as we've seen in voice and in FemPrep, then how are we going to get something that is going to be just a coitally related product, and what would the trial design look like possibly?
Well, that's true. I think that is a challenge, but I think by putting the right minds together, we should be able to come up with the right pharmacology and the right way to look at that. But it's, I think, a lot easier to compare, apples to apples, even though it might be red apples and green apples, than to have apples with I can't really take this metaphor that much further, but, the situation where you have different dosing regimen, I think it's always a little bit more tricky than just having a straight head-to-head comparison.
But actually, picking up on that, I mean, is there something here? You were very clear, Veronica, about that we should unite. And actually, a lot of what we heard from Rive's talk and from Catherine Dodds yesterday is about uniting across intellectual and disciplinary boundaries. Because actually, to do coital trials requires a whole variety of different skills. How do we go forward with getting sort of combined funding or getting these academic barriers down? Have you got an easy answer for us before lunch?
So, I think a lot of it can be driven by sponsors in terms of the kinds of engagement that they encourage. I think this kind of a meeting obviously, encourages that as well. We could think about having a protected area where these stakeholders could meet and exchange ideas and stimulate each other's thinking. That might be the ideal way to go forward, but it's very hard when I think when we had the 7 trials going on, we could have this prep trial as working group, but there were 7 individual trials going on. Now that you have all of these demonstration projects and new trials coming in, really finding the right venue to make that happen is something we need to think about. I agree.
Yeah. Last point before lunch.
Oh, Jane, over here, because you keep missing the microphones over here.
Okay. They've got lights in our eyes for being Spanish Inquisition.
Is it okay just because it's specifically to speak to that point?
Very good.
It's a great, it was a great talk, Veronica. Thanks so much. But the open label design, which I feel terrible I never wrote to the FDA to say you must think about open label, this randomization to for immediate access to product compared to deferred, so that you have a sort of control period in individuals, but at least you have an honest dialogue with participants about the fact they're getting a product that you believe to be effective. Mm-hmm. Because I think now we've got so much data about the biological efficacy of antiretrovirals used in HIV-negative populations, we have to have that dialogue. And then at least you are asking people to take the product for themselves, not just for you as the study team. I think that's so important, and I feel terrible I never wrote to the FDA to say you must think about this design.
Well, they'd love to hear from you. They're always asking for comments and input.
Question. Thank you. Ed Lindhorst from the Dutch HIV Association. I do very much agree about to unite all the actors, as you mentioned. What I missed, though, is the unification of the people who are going to influence policy. I think one of the steps we have to make is that, okay, we can unite all scientifics, we can unite all implementations for patients or for other people. But what I miss is the implementation. How are we going to get policymakers so far that they are really following all the solutions that we are getting?
Yeah, no, that's a real good point. And I guess when I was doing that, I was thinking about the regulators in terms of, you know, getting the right clinical trial designs that they would accept. But obviously the next step then is the policymakers for implementation. And we shouldn't wait until something is approved before we involve
exactly.
them. So that was an error on my part. I should have I'll immediately update the slides before they get posted.
Thank you.
Final point.
Just, Mitchell Moore, Nadevac. And I just think this issue of over here, Veronica. Hi.
Yeah, I'm just
lighting's
trying.
Terrible.
No,
I feel terrible for you. I think this issue, and you raised it, efficacy and effectiveness, and I think in the vaccine discussions where efficacy and effectiveness are much more similar and sometimes identical depending on the vaccine regimen, to Helen's point, I think one of the issues in many of the user-controlled methods that have been studied is we actually are really doing effectiveness studies. We take a lot of people, many of whom, as Rivet very nicely articulated this morning, aren't adhering. I guess the question really to think about as a collective is, can we move to a truer type of efficacy study in the recruitment and retention of participants who may not be broadly representative of the eventual user profile that we want to achieve for public health impact, but may give us biologic proof faster and with greater degree of certainty?
And that's exactly what I was trying to say, and thank you for stating that more clearly. But, you know, when I talk about the optimal conditions and enriching for adherence, et cetera, that's exactly it. So let's first kind of get a handle on how it works, and then we can talk about how it might work in different populations. So
thank you for a very, very, very stimulating
lunchtime
session. I think we've all heard really. So we'll break now for lunch, which is...